The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So as we're waiting for people to come in, we can take this time also, if you have any questions about what we've done this last few weeks about the instructions or your meditation practice, this is a good opportunity for that.
Mentioned attending to emotions, the rain.
Yeah.
And you said, in the handout, it said naming, but you called it non-identification. And I don't know if you have an opportunity to do print that or read. Is there something?
No, I didn't. Yeah, so several people.
Information, instruction on that, please.
Oh, so, yeah, so. 2 weeks ago when I talked about emotions, I went through an acronym called RAIN, which is very popular in the Vipassana world, and it stands for recognize, allow, allow, investigate, and non-identification. So it's kind of four different perspectives of how to work with emotions. It's important to recognize you have them, because if you don't recognize it, then and they're there, that could cause all kinds of difficulties. And then allowing doesn't mean condoning necessarily or just acting on them, but it means not interfering with them, not judging them, just kind of letting them be there, especially in the context of meditation. And investigation means to go and look at it more carefully. What is this actually, this experience, the present moment experience? Not to analyze why it's there from the past, but to really get into the different component parts of what makes up an emotion as a way of kind of stepping back and not being caught in the emotion or pushed around by it, but to begin to kind of tease apart what makes it up. And non-identification means that we don't define ourselves by the emotion and define ourselves as being a good person, a bad person, all kinds of reasons. I'm this kind of person, I'm that kind of person because of the emotion. And that's a very common teaching for the last 20 years in our wider Vipassana world. And I've never taught it before. But for 20 years, I've been teaching something a little different that I came up with on my own, which is what's in the handout. And last time, 2 weeks ago, and what I had in the handout is that it doesn't really make an acronym, but it's kind of the same letters, but in a different sequence, R-A-N-I. So it's certainly recognize, allow, and then to name the experience. There's something very powerful about the act of naming. In some cultures, if you know someone's birth name, you have power over them. Or if you name the monster kind of dissolves or goes away or something. There's something very powerful in the act of naming that takes the power out of the that we give to our emotions, the kind of seduction we have to them, or the fascination we have with them, the horror we have to them. The naming is a way of stepping back and just kind of being, it's kind of more in the field of allowing, just kind of see clearly what's there. And then the I, for me, was investigate. So for some reason, 2 weeks ago, so the handout is how I usually teach it. And for some two weeks ago, I'm going to try out teaching the way I've never taught before, the way all my colleagues teach it. But then I ended up confusing people because the handout is different than how I taught. So that's the story. And I didn't change the handout, and I can't go back and change the tape, the recording. So I apologize, that was confusing. But one way of looking at it is you got more. You have more options, more tools for how to work with it. Do you want to ask more, or is that enough? Great, thank you. Anything else? Chance to ask? Sometimes it's nice to ask. Yes, please.
Good evening.
Yeah.
I think I have what's probably a common problem, where some days I feel like I can be present and be mindful to the breath, to the other things that come up. And there are other days when I find it really hard to be mindful for the 20 minutes, the 25 minutes, or the 30 minutes. My sense is you would recommend being mindful, that I'm having trouble being mindful. But at the same time, as beginners, how do we, what suggestion do you have for dealing with the ebb and flow of this journey, of the beginning of it?
Yeah, one of the first things to learn on this path of meditation is patience. And so to learn patience, and to learn to be patient with what is and the challenges that arise, and just hang in there and persevere, because things change, and they change over time. And one of the things we're learning in this kind of meditation practice is to learn to be at ease with the changing nature of our life. So there are times we sit and meditate and it's relatively easy. Sometimes we have challenges in the day, and the daytime challenges fill our meditation, and we have to learn how to be present for that in a way that's easeful or equanimous. And all kinds of things, when you're in pain, you have a headache, all kinds of things go on. And so to learn to be, to have certain kind of confidence in the value of being mindful for what is, as opposed to what we want to be, what we want. And Buddhism has a lot of ideals, and when there's, we say that when there's a difference between the ideal and the actual, always choose the actual. So just really be there for what's really going on. So what's interesting, what you said, some days it's hard. Hard is an interesting word, and it can trip people up, and kind of people react to the word hard, but it's an abstraction. It's a second level kind of evaluation of the situation that can make it difficult to see what was really going on. If you look behind the label of hard, what's actually going on? What is the actual experience?
I would say being feeling unsettled.
Uh-huh.
I would say focusing or having trouble with having multiple sensory experiences go on internally, and pinpointing one of them to have my attention on. Focusing on. Just it's sort of letting my mind wander, not being present, not settling into my own body, but being in my head and being with my thoughts rather than watching my thoughts.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice report. It's what makes that hard?
Because I then feel it's like swimming. I would describe it between swimming downstream,
mm-hmm.
and working with myself and my breath and body and all of that versus swimming upstream, resisting what I'm feeling and maybe applying expectations to that, yeah. Or applying ideals to that, or removing myself from where I'm at.
Good. So probably underneath that is some belief. You believe one thing's supposed to happen and something else is actually going on. So if you can identify the belief, you might be able to come free of being caught by that. So, you know, being unsettled is an interesting thing. If you're restless or unsettled in meditation, it can be fascinating to sit there and feel the energetics of that. I've sometimes felt very restless in meditation, and I find it a kind of a trip to sit there, and it feels like ping pong balls bouncing around inside, and the legs want to bolt, and you know, all these energy. And if I just kind of settle back and into the restlessness of it, going along for the show, it can be a lot easier. Then if I go, oh no, this is, shouldn't be, I should be calm, and just kind of relax into it and just be restless. And then sometimes there can be a lot of things going on at once. You say you talked about multiple sensations coming at once. And sometimes the way mindfulness is taught, it seems like you're supposed to ground your attention in one thing particular. And sometimes when there's a lot going on, the appropriate label, the appropriate thing to back off and just call it chaos. Just and be your present for this, the grand total of chaos at that moment, and that can be a lot easier than trying to sort of probe into it and find some place that's the thing. It's just the whole package is what needs to be attended to and held and be present for. And in this way, what we're learning is we're learning to be present for our life as it is, and then finding a kind of freedom with how it is, as opposed to needing our life to change. And if we're always needing to change our life, then we're going to be busy for a long time, because, you know, life changes. Life itself brings all kinds of ups and downs and changes of all kinds. And so, you know, what can we bring to our experience that gives us stability, gives us some kind of freedom from it? And it's not the experience itself, but how we relate to it. Make sense? One more, and then we'll do a meditation. Yes. If you can use this mic, please.
I think I understood in the writings that you had mentioned that when something is... when a story is going on during the meditation, and then to name the emotion, sometimes that takes more
thinking.
Yes. It can convolute the situation even more than just letting the story.
I can't do that if you're trying to analyze or if you. Some people have a very, I'm not saying this is your case, but some people have a very small emotional vocabulary, so they can't quite, they don't quite know what's going on. There's a famous story from a retreat many years ago of a person who came to the teacher and said, I'm feeling something strange. And the teacher said, oh, just go investigate. Come back in a few days and tell me what it is. The person came back a few days later and said, it's calm. I've never been calm in my life. And so it took a while to realize what was going on. So generally the principle is we don't spend a lot of time analyzing. If it's not obvious, then don't worry about it. But the idea is what's the obvious feeling tone, sensations, what's the mood, what's kind of in the background, kind of behind, around, on top, surrounding the story making? And if it's not easily accessible, don't worry about it. Generally if no mood or emotion is easily discernible, probably you're not that strongly wedded to the story making. And so maybe you can just let go of it and come back to your breathing. Okay. So I want to give you an image for mindfulness meditation that it's worth kind of storing away and maybe calling upon as a reference. And that is the image of a one-room house. Little house, teeny house, one of these teeny houses, which is one room. And in the middle of that one room house is an easy chair. And you're sitting in that easy chair, taking it easy. The door is open to the outside, the windows are open, and there's five windows and a door. You're sitting there and you're looking out, you see the scene outside, the yard or the trees or the neighborhood. And sometimes there's an animal that runs across the porch and peeks its head in through the door. And it's a cat sometimes a dog, you know, different things. And sometimes a bird, flies by the window. Sometimes a bird lands on the windowsill and flies away. And so you just kind of sit there and you watch all this. But then along comes a really cute rabbit by the front door. You know, that's interesting. And so you get out of your chair and go out there to kind of follow and chase the rabbit. Another time, there comes a huge elephant that could never get through your door. But you cower and run away, you know, into the closet. You get off, you get out of the easy chair. The idea is that the five windows and the door in Buddhism, and Buddhism uses this symbol explicitly for this, the house symbolizes a person, that the five windows are the five ordinary sense doors that we have: hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching. Is that all? That's five? Okay. And then the door is that what's called the mind door, the ability to kind of know what's going on in your mind, know what you're thinking and all that. So Buddhism calls it six senses. And all kinds of things will appear at your senses. Sense windows, sense doors. thoughts will arise, feelings will arise, sounds from outside, experiences, smells, all kinds of things will arise. And the idea is to stay, keep your awareness, your mind, in the easy chair, relaxed, at ease, and just allow them to come there. Don't go out to chase them. Don't leave your chair. But also, you don't have to cower and close up and go and, you know, hide in the closet. But just keep staying in the easy chair. And that's the training in mindfulness, to be clearly mindful of what is. Be aware, recognize what's happening, but to do it kind of in a relaxed way, in this easy chair. It means that you shouldn't try too hard in meditation to analyze, to figure out. You shouldn't be striving too much to be successful. Meditation is a little bit counterintuitive. For many people who are into doing a lot, accomplishing by doing, meditation is not about a lot of doing. You have to do some doing. But sometimes I liken it to, running a marathon. You don't go all out the first mile. You kind of pace yourself and go kind of slow and steady. And so with meditation session two, you don't go all out to be completely 100% present, impeccably. Hopefully more than 20% of your effort, but you give, you don't want to try too hard. Meditation is the kind of thing that you're more successful if you don't try to be successful. It's kind of just comes mostly a lot of relaxation, a lot of letting go. And you have to try, you have to make effort, but you have to be very careful how the effort you make. And so the image of staying in the easy chair and making the effort to see what's coming at the window and the door is the effort you need, but not the effort that takes you out of that easy chair. So hopefully that gives you an image that you can carry with you. So what I'd like to do this evening is to go through the instructions I've given so far, and it is a kind of review. And it's a progressive instruction in mindfulness. And for those of you who, as it gets more, the progress goes on, it starts getting more complicated or too much, it's basically enough just to go back to your breathing and start at the beginning. Keep it really simple. The earlier steps are the most important. And you can always just default to go back there. And if you're confused what to do, then the instructions are just go back to your breathing rather than trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do and what was Gil saying, what step am I at now, and all that. Almost everything you need to know in meditation will be revealed if you come back and stay with your breathing and just stay there. Everything else is kind of supportive for the basic idea. So take a meditation posture that's upright and alert, while at the same time being a little bit relaxed. And gently close your eyes. And take a few long, slow, deep breaths, feeling your torso expand, your shoulders lift, rib cage move out as you breathe in. And then as you exhale, relax. Long, slow exhale. And doing this is a way of connecting to your body and settling into your body. And then letting your breathing return to normal. And scanning through your body to see if there's some obvious places that you can relax. Common places, the muscles around the face, the eyes, the jaws. Softening the shoulders. and softening the belly. And then bring your awareness to notice how your body experiences breathing. What moves in your body as you breathe? Your chest, your belly. What's the strongest sensation in your body? That corresponds to breathing, lets you know you're breathing. Or what's the most comforting experience of breathing that you have? Some people find it nice to stay with the air going in and out through the nostrils. Sensations. Nostrils, some people the movements of the chest, some people the movements of the belly, some people kind of the whole broad experience of breathing throughout the body. And naturally the mind at some point will wander off in thought. And then when you notice that, begin again with your breathing. A big part of meditation is always being willing to begin again. Especially as you exhale, to let go of your thoughts so that you can better feel the physical experience of breathing. If there are thoughts in the background and in the foreground you can stay with your breathing, don't worry about those thoughts. Stay with your breathing. And then take a moment to shift your attention. Remember to stay in the easy chair. Staying there relaxed, shift your attention to the strongest sensation in your body. And see if you can be aware of it in an equanimous manner. Letting that be what your mindfulness notices. Allowing it to be there. An open awareness that feels it fully, as if you've never felt such a thing before. It's the first time. And you're curious, what is this? If it goes away as you're paying attention to it, then look for the next strongest sensation in your body. And then come back to your breathing. And reestablish attention with the rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. Kind of like the breathing is an internal massage. Massages you better if you're really right there to experience the rhythm of changing sensations, breathing in and breathing out. Feeling the exhale all the way to the end of the exhale. And then switching your attention from the breathing to how you're feeling. What's the mood or the emotional state that you have? Any emotion or attitude, mood? And without leaving your easy chair, take in the presence of this state. How you are, as if it's okay. You're allowed to feel this way. But don't leave the easy chair. No need to judge it, get involved in it, pull away, approve of it or disapprove. Take some time being aware of it as it is in the moment. As if you're perceiving it, feeling it for the first time. What is this? And then come back to your breathing. And reestablish yourself with the experience of breathing, the life breath that's been your companion for a lifetime. It's been with you for a long time, and now for these next few minutes you can be with it, accompanying it, being its companion, breathing in and breathing out. And then switching your attention from your breathing to notice yourself thinking, if you do. If you're not thinking, come back to the breathing. But whenever there's thoughts, don't let go of them. Just be aware of them. See them clearly for what they are, and try not to be involved with them, but to see them, like you look them right in the eye, thinking, I see you. I know that I'm thinking. This is thinking. If thinking is strong, you might notice what emotions might be coming along with the thinking. And if there are emotions, practice mindfulness of the emotion. Then bring your attention back to your breathing. And settle into the experience of the body breathing. Letting it be the home base for awareness. And as you stay with your breathing, from time to time there might come thoughts, feelings, sensations, sounds might arise. Stay in your easy chair and just know it. So there's a clear grounding in the present moment experience. And when things are acknowledged, if it feels right, then you can go back to your breathing. Continue with your breathing. And if while you're sitting here, there's a reaction or attitude about what's happening or about the meditation itself, let that be what you're mindful of. So if you're impatient or restless or delighted or really settled and calm, whatever it might be, step back and look that right in the eye. Know that that's happening. It's a way of turning around and looking at it. So you are not it. You're not the reaction. It's just another phenomena to be aware of. So another minute or so of sitting here, and this last minute, see if you can relax into your breathing more fully. So in the relaxing and letting go into breathing, you stay present for each breath, for the minute. And then to end this sitting, you can take a few long, slow, deep breaths, feeling your body from the inside, feeling contact with the chair or the cushion. And then when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Thank you. So the instructions over these weeks have been, at the heart of this meditation practice is mindfulness of breathing. But then when there are sensations of your body which are more compelling than the breathing, then you let go of the breathing and you are mindful of the sensations of your body. Anything that's happening in the present moment can be the place we train our mindfulness, train our ability to be in the present. So if there's strong bodily sensations, they become the place of training. If there are strong emotions, they become the present moment experience that we stay present for and learn how to be here, present in a full way. If thinking is strong, then that's the place we be mindful of. And then the thing I want to add today is that sometimes what's strong is our attitude or our relationship to the experience we're having. So that, if I'm holding this striker, and I really don't like this striker. I think it's like the really bad make of a striker. There should be better strikers in meditation centers, and I really dislike it strongly. My dislike can be so strong that it's stronger than my experience of the striker. I can get lost in my world of dislike and what it means and all that. So my relationship to the striker has become a bigger experience than the striker itself. And so sometimes when you're sitting like following the breath, we might have a relationship with breathing that's actually the bigger deal, the more prominent thing. But because it has to do with the relationship, we think it's nothing to do with the experience. So for example, with the breathing, the relationship might be frustration that the breath doesn't seem to be deep and satisfying because it's shallow and fast. And so the frustration is the... If it's stronger than the breathing, then we want to take that into account and turn around and look at that and be mindful of that. And a lot of freedom and a lot of personal strength can come when we can turn around and really see what the reaction, the attitude, the judgments that we have about experience, and we see it clearly for what it is, but we don't automatically buy into it. We don't automatically accept it, go along with it, but instead we see it respectfully. So the relationship to things, how we're paying attention, how we're relating to it. So I know some people, like if there's something uncomfortable in the body, the resistance to the pain might be stronger than the pain, might be more stronger experience. But because the resistance is just resistance, right? That's just, you're supposed to be resisting or something. Some people, doesn't occur to them to notice that. So they struggle trying to stay with the pain. But sometimes what you need to do is leave the pain alone and notice the resistance or notice the fear. There might be a lot of fear around certain pain. And it's the fear in relationship to it that needs our attention. So by doing that, then the attention becomes all-inclusive. It becomes all our direct experience, whatever we're having, and our relationship to the experience, how we're attending to it. And what we're trying to do here in mindfulness practice is learn how to have an equanimous, balanced, alert, clear attention to what's happening in the present moment, no matter what's happening in the present moment. And that's the ticket, in Buddhism at least, to becoming free. Without that kind of clarity to everything, then you can be free a little bit, but then you're free only to some things. But if you can learn how to have an attention, present moment attention that has a certain kind of clarity or directness or fullness to it. So it's with time, the awareness becomes the predominant thing. The awareness becomes a thing in its own right. If someone works with their hands a lot, they might focus so much on their tools and what they're doing, appropriately so, but at some point they become aware of what an amazing tool the hand is. And they're kind of in awe and amazed. Wow, this hand is quite something. And I actually can do things with my hand. So the same thing with awareness. Awareness is sometimes lost in what we're using awareness for. We're paying attention to all kinds of things. We're concerned about things and all that. But anything you're concerned about, anything you're aware of, to be connected to it, you have to be aware of it. But as the mindfulness, present moment mindfulness gets stronger, this wonderful treasure starts to become stronger. The treasure of awareness. It becomes like as fully present in your life as a hand would be for, you know, someone who was working with their tools, or I don't know what, but it becomes a kind of a... this is the analogy. Maybe I've used it before. Here in the Bay Area, it's often smoggy. You know, not that smoggy compared to some cities, but, you know, it's hazy, smoggy. And I can go around for weeks and kind of just take it for granted, not think about it at all, until someday there's been a rain or a strong wind, and it's blown it all away. And then I see the hills in the East Bay, look across the bay, and I'm kind of stunned by the clarity. I'm so surprised there's hills over there, and they're so close sometimes if it's clear enough. And what stands out in highlight is the clarity of the air. And wow, that's great. And it's kind of, I feel kind of awe, I feel kind of delight, I feel this is a treasure to feel this clarity. But the clarity is not a thing, right? The clarity allows you to see things through it. And so the clarity, maybe, you know, normally you wouldn't think it has any value, but on that day, wow, this is really great. So the same thing with the mind, with awareness. When the awareness becomes very present and clear, it's kind of like the clouds have gone, or the smog has gone, and wow, this is quite something to have this clarity. This is great. And I've not even had any coffee. And so to have this clarity, and then to value it, is part of what happens in Buddhist practice. Wow, this is a great thing. This is like, you know, a new dimension of my life that I can take advantage, I can resort to, I can develop, I can live from. And it's a great thing to live from this place of clarity and wakefulness, because that's a seed for greater freedom, ease in our life, not being caught in things. It's also the medium for wisdom. And Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on the value of wisdom and the clear seeing of what it is. And so maybe I'll give you an example of a wisdom thing, that how this really clear present moment attention can give birth to a kind of wisdom that Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on. And at the same time, it comes in kind of freedom. Can I have that big striker? And is there a pen over there too? I don't have my pen. Does anybody have a pen? Do you have a pen? Yeah. Todd has a pen. So what I want to show you, so I want to show you something. So here we have this famous striker. Actually, if you like it, it's fine. And so here we have a striker. And if I hold up the striker by itself, it's just a striker or a piece of wood or something. And it just is what it is. It's just complete in itself, is what it is. In Buddhism, we call it the suchness of something. It's just such, or the thusness. It's just thus, just what it is. But now I can do something that changes the whole thing or adds something to it. Now I can hold up this striker. And now I can say something I couldn't say before. Now I can say that this is the short striker, and this is the long one. Right? So this now it's been born as a short striker. You saw the birth of it as a short striker. And now, watch the magic. You can see how the hand trick works. So this was the short, this is the long, right? So, which is the... Now, the magically, in front of your very eyes, the short one became the long one. Do you see that? Should I do it again so you can catch how it's done? So... The short and long does not reside in the striker. Short and long resides in my mind, in what I choose to compare it to. So if you allow something to be just the way it is just itself. But if we get involved in judging it, evaluating, comparing it to other things, then it gets more complicated. Turns out a lot of human suffering as related to the world of comparative thinking. A lot of personal suffering. You're too tall, you're too short. Some of you probably thought that about yourself. But then you can, you know, if you say that to yourself, you then reply, compared to what? And do you want to live in a world where you're constantly comparing yourself? What about the suchness of you? Do you have any sense of what it's like to rest in the thusness of you, just as you are, allowing yourself to be as you are, independent of all the comparison, the thought, the conceptual evaluation that's needed to see short, long, big, small. You know, when I was younger, I had all kinds of things that I was caught up in. I was of the hippie era, and so it made a big deal how long my hair was. And my status in society had a lot to do with the length of my hair, and I would sit in class pulling it so it would grow faster. And, you know, because I was comparing myself to hair length. And also the other thing I compared myself to was length, the size of the forehead. I was concerned that I was going to have receding hairline when I was 13. And so I spent a lot of time in class measuring my hairline, my fingers. And so this world of comparative thinking, you know, and we do that all the time, right? We're better or worse than others. We're better or worse than who we were yesterday or who we think we should be. We have all these comparisons that we do. And some of that is appropriate. There's a time and place for comparison and contrast. But if that's the only world we live in, many people suffer a lot. If we can just let ourselves have the experience of just the suchness of who we are, just as we are, it's a great thing. Some people live under tremendous suffering that society puts on them, because society does the comparing for them. You know, and you're, you know, whoever you are, you don't fit in, you don't belong, you're like wrong or some way. And but you yourself, the experience of breathing and being alive and being a body, that's not a comparison. That just is. It's a thusness of it. And so to learn to have the experience of resting in the thusness, the suchness of yourself, independent of the comparisons, is one of the great experiences of freedom that can be found in this practice. But it takes time to learn to tease apart the commentary, tease apart the reactions, tease apart the attitude. It takes time to see how the thinking works. But to see that, oh, that's a thought. I just had a comparative thought. It's just a comparison, as opposed to it's the truth. But if we don't see it as a thought, they're just operating there. It's kind of like, it's like the wizard in The Wizard of Oz, those of you who saw that movie. You know, this big booming voice coming out of the wall, I think, remember what, like, and then at some point Toto the dog pulls the curtain and it's just a little, you know, plump little guy, you know, who seems kind of harmless. So we pull the curtain from our own mind, the great authority of the wizard in our mind that tells us all kinds of things. And we say, oh, you know, it's just a thought. The cute little person there behind the curtain. And then we can begin to rest in the suchness. So this is kind of the wisdom of Buddhism, the wisdom of seeing clearly what's what, and teasing apart these things in the moment. It's not like analysis, it's not like figuring it out. We start seeing it so clearly. Wow, there's a thought, there's a feeling, there's a reaction. And slowly begin to kind of let it just be very simple, without all the layers of reactions and second arrows and commentary. And the great gift to yourself is to be able to sit in meditation or walk, go for a walk or do something, and just you're allowed to be exactly as you are and be at ease with that and rest. The suchness of you, the thusness of you, independent of all the stuff that goes on. So that's a kind of a wisdom approach of Buddhism. The other wisdom thing that's important to hear from Buddhism in this regard is as we can stay quiet or still enough or clear enough in our attention, maybe clear is the right word here, then we can start seeing what we're adding. What are we doing extra that's causing suffering? So if I'm holding the striker really hard, because now the striker is the best striker and I don't want to let it go, I'm so focused on the striker and preventing you guys from stealing it, I don't notice how much I'm attached to it, how much I'm gripping it really tight. As my awareness gets clear and I see more clearly, I see the grip I feel the grip. I say, I don't have to grip it so much, so I can let go. More importantly, I might see the evaluation, the belief, that my status as a good meditation teacher depends on the quality of my striker. And I better protect this, because that's going to protect me and my reputation. So I can see those thoughts coming up to my mind, and I can see that those thoughts, if I grab onto them, they cause suffering. And I don't have to believe them, I don't have to grab onto them. I can relax around those thoughts. I can even let go of those thoughts. So part of the wisdom aspect of this ability to see clearly is we start seeing what we add that's extra to the present moment. And then to learn to be, in a certain way, simpler. But simpler in such a way that we can also be more effective and more direct and more kind of fully responsive to what's here. In a way that we can't if we're behind this veil of desires and impulses and aversions and judgments and all this. So the wisdom of appreciating the thusness of just this, how we are, and the wisdom of beginning to understand what we add that's extra, and how some of the extra stuff we add is the source of our suffering, is the key wisdom pieces that Buddhism tends to offer. So before I go on anymore, do you have anybody want to say something about what that meditation was like? Any questions, or what was that to do, that kind of overview meditation that I just did for all of you? Any comments about that? Thank you. Just really calm and peaceful, and the last thing you want to do is talk? Is that what's happening? Or are you confused by all this and stunned?
It was very peaceful and relaxing. I was imagining myself at this. I was looking on Craigslist a few days ago at this apartment or this house for rent in Calistoga. And it was a peaceful little picture of a wooden floor room and a wood burning stove in it and stuff. And so I was there in this an easy chair. It was through the meditation. It was hard for me. I was focused on a kind of a pain in my back that would come and go, and then as I would focus on breathing, I wouldn't really notice it so much. And
so it was a pleasant. The whole thing was a pleasant experience.
Yeah,
great. Thank you. Okay, well, maybe I should go on then. Say more? You ready for more? Yes, please. I don't think you've been here before, have you?
Blessings, no. This is my first time.
Okay, so this is actually the last class, so let's see what you want to... Go ahead.
Thank you. I was aware, after following the prompt, that beneath the veneer of modernity, the anxiety, the stress... is the omnipresent memory of our birth.
Mm.
By meditating on the fact that we are here in this moment and present, we must have emerged from a place unlike that which causes us this anxiety.
Mm.
There is always an opposition. There is always a pull. And this is a lesson that all children give us when they struggle to sit still.
Mm.
When we struggle to justify why we tell them they are wrong.
Mm.
It is within that that all constructions of age, responsibility, disappear.
Nice.
And as Buddha says, invite this smile.
What?
As Buddha says, invite the smile.
The smile.
And that becomes the final thought.
The final what?
Thought in this
font.
Meditation.
Font.
The final thought that I was
the
able
to... final thought. I thought my ear, my hearing's not so good. I thought you said font, like, you know, like print font.
That'd be cool, too.
That'd be too
cool. After finding all the anxiety and all the thoughts that you mentioned.
Yeah. Great.
Going through that, was able to bring me that sense
of peace. This idea, the word that he used was, one of the words he used was construction. And so in Buddhism, they put a lot on seeing the mental constructs that we make, so the thoughts, the judgments, evaluations, and then learning to see through those and find a certain kind of freedom that's free of construction. And ultimately in Buddhism, they have the word the unconstructed. And that's a place of awareness, dimension of awareness, where it's free of the thoughts or free of the constructs that we often live our life. And it's a great gift to ourselves, and it's a very empowering thing, because then we set ourselves free from all the social constructs that we've been struggling and living under and sometimes oppressed by, and to have an experience of just being alive, that kind of freedom without the social constructs and the weight of that, is a beautiful thing. So mindfulness, so the focus on this class has mostly been meditation, and but the mindfulness that I've been teaching you is equally valid in daily life. And in fact, the line between meditation and your daily life, you know, it's an arbitrary line. It's the same mind, whether you meditate or if you're walking around. And one of the very satisfying parts of this practice is when people get a hang of developing this clarity, developing this present moment awareness, this kind of freedom, ease, or calm in meditation. And then they decide, why don't I try to cultivate this and develop this in daily life as well? Why don't I get the benefits of being mindful in the present moment in my daily life as well? And then people start bringing that into their daily life. And it's a hard thing to do, but it can be done in pieces. Slowly start doing certain things. So for example, some people find it very, very helpful in their lives to take maybe one meal a day or one meal a week or something, and just eat. Don't have the any devices on, don't have music on, don't listen to the news, don't read the news, don't have, you know, don't talk to anyone. Just really be there very simply and be present for the experience of eating. And then we start kind of learning the value of being present, and we're strengthening that capacity to be present rather than being preoccupied with something and always filling our attention with something. Some people will choose particular activities that they want to focus on for a while to develop a strong sense of mindfulness, like becomes a meditation activity in itself. And it can be something as easy as cleaning the dishes. You finished eating your food at home, and the whole whatever process you have of getting your dishes clean, whether it's washing them in the sink or rinsing them in the sink, then putting a dishwasher, whatever you might do, but to be there fully for that. Just be present for that. So I'll tell you a story. It's a somewhat well-known story in our insight meditation world. There's a wonderful teacher, Filipino-American teacher named Kamala Masters, lives in Hawaii. And she got interested in this practice when she was a single mom with four kids. And somehow, I don't know how she managed to do it, but she was able to go on a retreat with an Indian mindfulness teacher named Manindra, maybe for a week or something. And at the end of the retreat, this Indian teacher said, it's really important to meditate every day. So she went up to him afterwards and said, you know, I can't. I have the four kids. I'm a single mom, four kids. I have to get them to school, make their lunches, do everything. It's not possible for me to do it. And this, basically a monk from India, who had never raised kids, knew nothing about the American kind of life of work. She had to work too, this woman, Kamala. She worked, four kids, and all that, right? He didn't know anything about that. He kept saying, oh, of course, everyone can meditate every day. You just have to do it. So she had the wherewithal to invite him home to come stay with her for a few days. And so he got to see what her life was like. And after a while, he said, you're right. And then he said, let me tell you what you can do. You can learn to practice mindfulness in your everyday activities. And so then he went with her around the activities she did and did them with her, or coached her. So washing dishes, just do the dishes. And watch when the mind wants to wander off in thought, just like in meditation, and come back and be there with the dishes. Become one with the dishes, just the dishes. You have emotions. Be aware of those emotions and keep kind of breathing, be with the dishes. Be present for that experience. Develop your capacity to be here with that simple activity. She had a hallway in her house that connected all the rooms. And so she, the teacher said, every time you step, you have to go through this hallway many times a day. Every time you step into this hallway, let that be your meditation hall where you do a walking meditation. So check in with yourself. Do present moment awareness in that hallway. Find out what's going on with you, how you're feeling, how you're breathing, how your body feels. Just be in the present moment there. So she started sprinkling throughout her day these present moment kind of exercises. And over the years, she did a tremendous amount of growth doing that without being able to meditate. And finally, when her kids got old enough, she went on in a long retreat. And she was so prepared that she just dropped very deeply into deep states of concentration very quickly from all the daily life practice she did. So some people find it actually more meaningful to practice in daily life than it is to meditate. Very, very rewarding for some people. A simple thing that I used to do, I don't do it so much anymore, but I would let the telephone ring 5-6 times before I answered it. And most people will wait that long. But I know about how it is for you, but I have this inner instinct, I don't know where it came from, that you have to let the least amount of rings go by. You have to get to the phone as quickly as you can because you'll lose the chance or something. And like losing the lottery, you know, who knows what's waiting there. And so this instinct to get quickly, I let go of and just, I waited. And what I do in those 5-6 rings is I would practice mindfulness. I would check in with myself. How am I right now? What's happening here? What's going on? How am I feeling? What's my posture? What's my energy like? What's my mood? And what the result of that simple check-in, is I was much wiser when I started the phone conversation. I was connected. I knew how I was. And the phone conversations tend to go a lot smoother than when I was just kind of quickly answered it and I didn't really know how I was and something. So that was a great thing I did. I've known people who have taken stickers and put little dot stickers on all the light switches in their house. And every time they're going to turn a light on and off, the stickers remind them, okay, be mindful now. Be in the present moment now. I know people who, when they drive to work, they park in the parking lot as far away from work as they can, and you know, reasonably so. And then they use the walk to their office or to wherever the work they're going to go as a place to do walking meditation, to walk mindfully and clearly. So they stay in the present moment experience of walking, just like in sitting you come back to your breathing, and walking meditation you come back to the experience of walking. And slowly over time, the capacity, the strength of mindfulness gets stronger. It's kind of like a muscle that gets stronger over time. And so mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and becomes a companion, a support that you don't want to really leave home without. It's a great thing to kind of go through. The other way of developing this practice is, so the practice becomes deeper, is to go on retreat. And we have a tradition of meditation retreats where it can be a day long. Here at IMC we have day long retreats. It can be a weekend, it can be a week. We have a retreat center in Santa Cruz. The standard length of our meditation retreats are 7 days. And there are other places you can go for longer. Some people will go for a month or 6 weeks or 3 months in different meditation centers around the country. And the retreats are silent retreats. Very little talking goes on. You talk to the teachers. The teachers give talks and instructions. But there's no social talking. So it's a lot of quiet. And it's an opportunity. It's an environment where you can give yourself over to meditating all day long, pretty much all day long. There's a little bit of work you have to do, working in the kitchen or cleaning pots or something, different things. And It's a great environment. The continuity of giving yourself over fully to one thing allows that thing to get stronger, allows the mindfulness, the meditation, the concentration to develop because it's uninterrupted. And this is a way of developing a stronger concentration as a companion, as an aid to the mindfulness. And to go get the most out of the kind of Buddhist path of this mindfulness meditation, we want to yoke, we want to bring together a strong concentration with a strong mindfulness. So it's not just clarity, but there's a real ability to be settled and focused on what we're looking at and what we're present for. And the word that's often used, the concept's often used, is so the mindfulness can become penetrating because of the strength of the concentration. So some people find that after they get into the meditation and feel more at home in it and it feels like it's nice for them, that at some point they find it very meaningful to go and do a retreat. And so that's another way of developing it. Finally, some people find that it's very hard to meditate on their own. They would like to. And it's good to get support of other people, meditators as well. So some people find it useful to, from time to time, once a week, once a month, something, to go meditate with other people who are also meditating. And there's a lot of meditation groups all over the peninsula, all over the country you can go to. It has a number of values to meditate with other people. One is that if you're the only person you know who's meditating, you go to work and your friends, and they all think you're weird. You might not think you're weird. But if you go meditate with other people and they look like normal people, they don't look like they're from Mars or anything, there are reasonable people doing this too. I'm not so strange after all, and it can give a little encouragement to keep going. The other thing is that we pick up by osmosis from other people a certain kind of confidence, encouragement, a certain sense of equanimity and presence, and what it means to do the practice, that it's hard to get from a book or from a talk, listening to someone. And so just to be around people, you don't have to talk to them, but just to kind of, by osmosis, being in the room with people. Some people find that meditating with others, they can get much more concentrated, and there's something supportive. Some people find that it's better to meditate at home, that being with other people is a little bit agitating. But even if it's agitating to meditate with other people, from time to time it's very helpful to do so anyway because of all the different other things that benefits that come from it. You're welcome to come to IMC anytime. We have basically programs every day of the week, sometimes multiple times during the day. Our newsletter, which is on the counter, has the schedule of all kinds of things that we do. The idea here at IMC is that it's somewhat casual, so that you can come and go as you wish. Nothing particular is asked of you. And different kinds of programs, some basic programs, beginner kind of programs, some for people who've been practicing for some time. But you're always welcome to check out anything you want here. And then, as I said last week, we have what's called the Beginner's Practice Program. So the 4 weeks after this class, starting next Wednesday, is kind of a follow-up on this one, where Tanya's not here, and Diana Clark are going to, there's kind of senior practitioners who've taught this class themselves before. They're going to just be here and do a review, give further instructions, have a lot of time for discussion, some exercises, some guided meditation. It's a kind of combination of things that you do. It's much more interactive, much more engaged than the kind of monologue that I've been giving today. And it's a very nice way of feeling support. So as you feel like it's nice to have some more support to keep going, and as you go on to these next over the next weeks and get started. So any questions now? Anything I've said? Anything that you want clarity for? Or anything that I haven't said that you'd like to me to address?
I just came tonight, and I thought it might be the beginning of the beginners
series.
But it's not.
Yeah.
So does that continue, or is that cycle in, or does it stop?
Well, this one is the last week of the five-week series, Intro to Meditation. And the Beginner's Practice Group starts next week, and it's 4 weeks. And it usually happens after this intro class. So I'll do this intro class again in the winter, in January, February. And then the Beginner's Practice Group starts again then. But you can come next week. It's It might be a misnomer to call it the Beginner's Practice Group because it's meant for people who did the intro class, but I think people come sometimes who think it's for raw beginners. It's because it makes sense, I guess. But it's fine to come if you're a raw beginner today. There's a review and it's very nice.
I was just wondering, like, is there a minimum amount of time to meditate? Like, for those of us that just 20 minutes is just drives us insane.
The minimum is half a breath.
Okay.
So, you know, you can get a lot of value. You can show up and wake up and be really present very quickly once you get the hang of it. But in terms of, realistically developing a meditation practice and having to build over time, I think there are a few things which I could say. One is that you're the best arbitrator for that. By trial and error, you experiment with different lengths. 1 week do 15 minutes, 1 week 20, 1 week 30 minutes or something. If you can, try different lengths and then see what the consequences are, the results of that, and see how it benefits and see if it fits into your life. Maybe you'd benefit from sitting half an hour a day, but your busy life doesn't allow it. So the best you can do is 10. So but experiment, find out. But generally, I would say that in order to develop some ongoing momentum and where it builds over time, it's probably good to do about 30 minutes a day. But it could be shorter. It could be longer. When I was first introduced to meditation, people I studied with, they did 40 minutes. So for many years, I thought that was like the right length, or it's what I did. So when I was in college, I did 40 minutes twice a day, when I first woke up and before I went to sleep. And that supported me through college very nicely. Yes?
Getting back to practicing mindfulness while you're doing daily things. Like a lot of folks around here, I spend plenty of time driving.
It's a great place to be mindful.
Is it a good idea to try to practice mindfulness while you're driving?
What's the alternative?
Road rage, I guess. I don't know.
What? Road rage?
I think since I've been coming to these classes and reading a book on meditation, I think I'm making attempts at that. I'm making attempts at not being in a hurry, kind of thinking about when that car over there cuts me off, how am I going to react to that, like preemptively. I think I'm doing this, but I just don't know if it's realistic to really practice or work on mindfulness while I'm actually driving around 2 tons of steel and rubber.
I think so. I think that, if we take mindfulness to be present moment awareness, heightened present moment awareness, you probably drive safer if you really stay in the present moment and, not get lost in your thoughts, not get lost in the telephone or the radio or whatever, whatever's going on, but just stay present for what's going on. Stay alert and aware. If that alertness and awareness teaches you about how you hold your stress and your tension, then you might learn that driving fast has a negative impact on your body. You actually tighten up a little bit and your eyes are kind of focused too much and there's too strong, it's easier to be impatient. and that you actually become a much more pleasant person to be around if you drive in the slow lane, you know, or close to it, you know, rather than rushing. So I think mindfulness is a great place to, driving is a great place to be mindful. One thing I've done, exercise I've done driving, is an exercise, kind of a kaleidoscope of emotions. I pay attention to the subtle shifting emotions that are constantly shifting as I drive. So, you know, like some, you know, really beautiful car drives by, and I go, "Oh, that's great! I want that. That's really great. I'm happy." And then someone kind of cuts me off, and I get angry. And someone else comes close to my tail, and I'm a little bit afraid. And it's maybe very subtle. It's not like really dangerous, but all these, it's constantly shifting. And I notice that person in the car, and a police car comes up close behind, and certain emotions arise, and police car goes away, and different emotions happen. And you know, it can be very, very subtle. It's like the kind of things you normally wouldn't even notice. But it's fun to watch how subtle and quick the shifting little emotions happen, as opposed to the big mood things. And I had a blast driving with that.
So this kind of is a follow-up to what you were talking about. What is your experience of meditation?
Everything. It's varied from day to day, meditation to meditation. But generally, I sit down, I'm pretty happy pretty quickly. A lot of joy arises for me. And there's often an experience of light and happiness and well-being. That's kind of the most common thing that happens to me. But sometimes I sit down and I'm restless. Sometimes I have a lot of thoughts swirling around. I had challenges with my 17-year-old son this weekend, and meditation was very thought-filled. And you know, I wasn't so settled. Sometimes there's very little thoughts, it gets very quiet. Sometimes I have a lot of thoughts. Sometimes there's not a lot of emotions, sometimes a lot of emotions. But I think, you know, one of the things that I value a lot, that I think is pretty constant in all my meditations, is kind of a heightened sense of being alive. Kind of a, wow, this is like, it's really, I'm really here in a full way. That's really nice. It's like I'm living my life rather than not present for it. Often in spiritual circles, there's an idea that many people aren't really present for their life. They're not really living their life. Does that make sense? Is that enough?
Yes.
I think that one of the things I focus on, though, is I'm not that interested in what my experience of meditation is like, so things I described. It's actually not as important for me as two things. One is that I'm mindful. I have so much confidence in mindfulness that just the chance to be mindful, I know, is so beneficial. So that's really what I focus on, just be mindful rather than the experience I'm having. So, and the other thing is that my ability to notice when I contract, when I cling, is so much better when I meditate. And so this ability to have the wisdom and understanding about how that works so I can stay free or stay at ease is something I value a lot. So it's more the consequence of meditation that's important for me, I would say, more than the actual experience. Experiences come and go. Yeah.
You touched on wisdom before. Can you expand on that a little bit? Maybe give some more examples.
More examples of wisdom. Wisdom in Buddhism has a lot to do with seeing clearly what's there, seeing things as they are. And so I'll give you an example. It's kind of building on something I thought of saying it earlier. So I mentioned being on retreats. And there's a great lesson that people who do retreats will learn over, they do a number of retreats. So retreats go through a pattern. Different people have different patterns in which they go, so there's no set pattern has to be. But one common pattern would be something like this. You'd show up, and you're all excited the first morning. Wow, I get to be a meditate, and finally I've been thinking about this for weeks, for months, and I finally cleared my calendar, I managed to get away. This is so great, this is so cool, a Buddhist retreat, it's so exciting. That's the morning, first morning. And then the afternoon, you're just like so tired, you're like, oh, I can't believe how tired I am, and just like falling over, and it's hopeless, why did I come here? I've used my precious vacation time, and I'm just like falling, but who are these people anyway, around me, these teachers don't know what they're talking about, and I'm just like, I should have gone to, vacation to San Diego. And then you go to sleep, the next day you wake up more clear, and it feels more like more settled and nice, and then the body begins to ache, and then the body hurts for a while, and then after a while the body mellows a little bit, and you get more concentrated, and then there's more calm and ease, and that's so nice. Oh, this is great. Ah, this is nice. This is what I came for. I think I need to call and email all my friends right away to tell them how great this is. They should come and do this too. And you become temporarily evangelist for meditation. It's like, oh, this is so great. And then the next day you sit down to have this great calm meditation. And because you're so calm and peaceful, some of the unresolved issues in your life begin bubbling up, and suddenly you feel like all this anger for your high school sweetie you haven't thought about for 40 years, because you never really resolved that kind of feelings and angst. And then, oh, this is terrible, and I'm a bad person. I was so peaceful and spiritual, and now I'm not. I'm filled with rage, and I'm a bad, this is terrible, and this is the end, and I'm going to be angry forever. And so that might be the first retreat. I mean, it's not that bad. I'm just making a point. Just kind of exaggerating a little bit, but after you do two or three of them, the wisdom that can come is it's always changing. It's all changing, and this idea that it's always changing means that you hold it lighter. You don't take it as you don't succumb to the delusion of permanence. I'm always going to be sleepy. I'm always going to be depressed. I'm always going to be this way. Oh, it's just, this is the flavor of the moment. This will change too. It's kind of like, I lived in Tennessee for a while, in the countryside, and they had a saying in Tennessee that if you don't like the weather, wait 10 minutes. And so, things will change. So what happens with people who've done a number of retreats is that they might have many of the same experiences the first time, but what's so precious and actually quite lovely is they're much more relaxed about it. They hold it lightly. These things come and go. And this thing we talked about earlier about not identifying, they no longer take it so personally. Just a thought, just a feeling. I don't have to take it so personally. And of course people have emotions. Of course people have desires and all these things. They come and they go. Of course they're tired. As opposed to, oh, I'm tired. There's just tiredness. Is that okay, wisdom? The wisdom of change and being relaxed about change? But you have to be present to see all that and to kind of learn to see it. So, thank you for coming and being part of this. I hope that this has been useful for you. And if you want to come back to IMC and participate here, you're always very welcome, every single one of you. We don't have any membership here officially. I like to say that if you want to be a member, you are. But if you don't believe in, being members, membership in spiritual communities, then just rest assured we don't have membership. We don't do that. So, but please come if you'd like. And there's our newsletter, and we have a website. The website lists a few sitting groups in the Bay here in the peninsula. There's one in Mountain View. There's one in San Jose is connected to us, Half Moon Bay, different places. And it'd be nice to see you again, and I wish you all well.